Hello and welcome to Nations of Charlemagne, episode 23, the French Revolution, the second part of this series on the French Revolution. Today we are going to be discussing the French Reign of Terror, which I've titled Virtue and Terror, of course, taking my cue from Maximilien Robespierre. Just a quick recap on what happened last time. We have the storming of the Bastille, the implementation of a constitutional monarchy in France, the declaration of war on Austria, the beginning of the First Coalition War, and the insurrection against the king on the 10th of August, which deposes the monarchy. Now that the king is deposed, we're talking about the radical stage of the Republican period, primarily from 1792 up until 1794, with some lingering elements still to cover from 1795 and 96, and ending off with the Conspiracy of Equals in 1796. Before I start, though, I want to talk about the revolutionary calendar and everything this represents about the revolutionary nature of this period, the first part of the Republican era. Anti-clericalism was one, if not the most persistent and virulent strains of the French revolutionary fervour. With the fall of the monarchy, the last bastion of a collapsing Catholic order in France, completely dissipated, permitting the revolutionaries to give full rein to their Rousseauian-esque state of nature experiment. With the proclamation of the French First Republic on the 21st of September 1792 was to be made year one of the French Republic. By October of 1793, the National Convention had adopted a new Republican calendar that retroactively made the 22nd of September 1792 the first of Vendémiaire, or the official start of the Republican era. Sylvain Maréchal was the first to promote the idea of a new calendar, alluding to the naturalist and neoclassical inclinations of the revolutionaries, with allusions to Rome and the year commencing from the spring equinox. In the name of rationalization, the number 10, the decade, reigned supreme, with the new metric system of measurement and a metric system of time. Charles Giron led the commission that created this new calendar, though d'Eglantin was its principal architect. For d'Eglantin, the calendar was a celebration of the natural world, agriculture, and the economy. Catholic saints' days were replaced with the veneration of useful things for the revolutionaries, plants, animals, raw materials, and of course, tools, mainly agricultural tools, tools to be used on the land. As the months were standardized to 30 days, years ended in 5 or 6 days of Republican celebrations. The 7-day week was abolished and replaced with the 10-day week in the name of rationalizing everything and allowing the number 10 to reign supreme over this new transformation of nature that we see with the French Republic. The creation of a new calendar was emblematic of the zeal and the ambition of the revolutionaries to completely refashion traditional France and subject her to a new cult of reason on a scale which only the Soviet Union rivaled in the modern era. Following the storming of the Tuileries Palace, the Legislative Assembly assumed the king's authority under a personal executive, rather a provisional executive. The royal family was imprisoned. Despite the creation of a provisional government, control of Paris was in the hands of Danton, and now Robespierre's insurrectionary commune, and the various Republican volunteers brought to Paris by the war, the Fédérés. The compromises between the radical and monarchist factions that underpinned the Constitution of 1791 were quickly undone by the commune, who seized the property of émigrés and armed the civilian population. The notion of a Montesquieu-esque separation of powers weakened as the commune came more and more to identify with the cause of the people as the cause of the revolution. Surveillance committees were established throughout Paris to deal with any suspected monarchist sympathizers, now all of them considered traitors. To centralize this process of treason trials and political convictions, an extraordinary revolutionary tribunal was created under the suggestion of Maximilien Robespierre to condemn the enemies of the revolution without the right to appeal. To exploit the presence of the volunteers before they were sent off to the front, the Fédérés, they carried out, the revolutionaries, a series of executions in the weeks following the storming of the Tuileries, so throughout all of August. The measures that Louis XVI had resisted against non-juror priests, those who would refuse to take the oath, subjecting themselves to the authority of the French nation and the new constitution, the civil constitution of the clergy. The measures that had been taken in the last days to try and banish them were implemented, and a number of them were banished from France. And in fact, a lot of them will be carted off in late October, September, around Paris, while Jean-Paul Marat called for the Parisian mob to execute priests and any known royal accomplices during the insurrection. On the 2nd of September, the Prussians took the main fortress at Verdun on the Eastern Front, giving the coalition forces, Austria, Prussia, Great Britain, and most of the nations of Europe at this time, a clear route to attack Paris. A general panic reigned in the capital, and it was suggested that the commune government flee the capital, though Robespierre was adamant that the revolutionaries should stand and die if need be. The prisons were full, and the Girondins, using the constitutional powers invested in what remained of the Legislative Assembly, wrestled with the Jacobins over control over Paris. The Jacobins controlled the insurrectionary commune, and the Girondins controlled the Legislative Assembly. Acting on the assumption that as soon as the army or the Federe left Paris to confront the Prussians in the field, the prisoners would lead their own counter-revolutionary insurrection, Marat called for a general massacre of anyone deemed suspect, utilizing the various surveillance committees throughout Paris. The massacres would be committed by violent criminals and hired killers, typically non-Frenchmen from Italy, Genoa, Sicily. On the 2nd of September, the day that Verdun had fallen, Georges Danton, the man more than anyone else who was probably responsible for the insurrection that toppled the king, delivered a speech in the Legislative Assembly as the Provisional Minister of Justice, declaring that anyone who wouldn't take up arms in the service of the revolution would essentially be cast as a traitor and merit the death sentence. The Jacobins tried to exploit the commotion of the mob to target their political opponents, Brissot and his Girondin supporters. The first mass slaughter occurred in the Carmes prison against 115 non-juror priests who were already bound for deportation in French Guiana. A similar massacre of the imprisoned Swiss Guard, those who had survived the original purge, occurred in the prison d'Abbaye. By September the 7th, the massacres inside Paris had ended, though 9 prisons had been stormed and as many as 1,500 people had been killed, including Marie Antoinette's confidant and lady-in-waiting, the Princess de Lamballe. Concurrently with the massacres, France held an election with a larger electorate than those who had elected the candidates in 1791. Through the Jacobin and Republican control of the press and intimidation of candidates, the elections produced an assembly that near unanimously supported the creation of a republic. The Legislative Assembly was transformed into the Provisional Government, the National Convention, with the election, while the election had confirmed the division of the Republican factions into moderate constitutional Girondins, who were opposed to September massacres, and the radical Jacobins, represented in the convention as the Mountain or the Montagnard faction, who had supported and helped instigate the massacres. The first meeting of the National Convention confirmed the creation of a republic, while the French victory at Valmy ended the imminent military threat to Paris and the possibility of a restoration of the monarchy. Nevertheless, as the revolution had begun with violence, the republic was founded amidst a wave of paranoia, violence, intimidation that would only escalate a process of radicalization under the pretext of a continuing national emergency. A national emergency that the nation is at war, facing war on all fronts against external and internal enemies. Louis Antoine de Saint-Just was only 25 when he was elected to the National Convention as its youngest member. As the author of The Spirit of the Revolution, L'Esprit de la Révolution, his political journey had followed the trajectory of the revolution itself, from a supporter of the constitutional monarchy in 1791 to a radical Jacobin after the storming of the Tuileries Palace. From a veritable unknown, his political tracks had very little readership. He thundered onto the political stage with a speech prior to the trial of Louis XVI. He, Louis, has oppressed a free nation. He declared himself its enemy. He abused the laws. He must die to assure the repose of his people, for no one can reign innocently. From the outset, he established himself as an ally of Robespierre, who echoed similar sentiments in the survival of the Republic, in that the survival of the Republic necessitated the death of its of the former king. When Louis was brought before the convention in December as a mere subject or citizen, Louis Capet, the speaker declared that the nation accuses you of a multitude of crimes to establish tyranny over and destroy freedom in the nation. The guilt of Louis was effectively predetermined. Nevertheless, he defended himself earnestly in the spirit of the Enlightenment, indeed in the manner of a citizen king, defending his prerogatives as outlined by the Constitution of 1791, and in that spirit denounced the legality of the convention to judge him. Desaix led the king's defence and declared, "He brought to the throne no wicked weakness, no corrupting passions. He was economical, just, severe. He showed himself always the constant friend of the people. The people wanted the abolition of servitude. He began by abolishing it on his own lands. The people asked for reforms in criminal law. He carried out these reforms," of course, alluding to the fact that even before the revolution, we see the streamlining of various medieval forms of punishment and the elimination of things deemed cruel and unusual punishment. "The people wanted liberty. He gave it to them. The people themselves came before him in his sacrifices. Nevertheless, it is in the name of these very people that one today demands, 'Citizen, I cannot finish. Think how it will judge your judgment, and that the judgment of him will be judged by the centuries.'" And it's interesting here that the king and his legal team fully embraced the idea of the Enlightenment and the idea of the king as an enlightened despot ruling concurrently or in the spirit of the Enlightenment, as opposed to, say, for example, taking the Mary Queen of Scots route and declaring that I am the sovereign of France and no authority can touch me. Instead, he is trying to tackle this in the spirit of the moderates of the revolution. Of all the charges levied against him, the charge of the intentional spilling of the blood of his countrymen, his subjects, now citizens, affected the king the most. The manner in which the convention voted to punish the king fell into political camps, with the mountain delegates voting for the king's death and the Girondins voting for his imprisonment and eventual banishment. Among the most notorious of the mountain to vote for the king's death was the king's cousin, the Duc d'Orléans, now dubbed Philippe Égalité. A vote to postpone the sentence failed, and the king was guillotined on the Place de la Concorde, renamed the Place de la Révolution, a month later. As he approached the scaffold, he attempted to utter some last words to the crowd. "I die innocent of everything of which I am accused. I pardon those who have occasioned my death, and I pray that my blood may cement the good fortune of France." As he was saying this, the drum rolls drowned out his words so they could barely be audible, and he was thrust into the stockade. Ultimately, he was decapitated. The royal family, including who was now the pretender, young Louis XVII, remained imprisoned in the temple, while Marie Antoinette would soon follow her husband to the guillotine, charged, among other things, with treason, collaborating with foreign powers, and even incest with her son. Of course, these were all trumped up and exaggerated, and in response to that, Marie Antoinette appealed and said to all the women observing her trial, "Judge me as a mother." And of course, the Revolutionary Tribunal had already determined her guilt, and so it was to no avail. Nevertheless, I believe that Marie Antoinette's last stand really does contradict all the elements of her as a frivolous, vainglorious creature, and actually demonstrate that she was, as was proven with her demonstration at the balcony during the Women's March in Versailles, a woman of incredible courage. Amidst France's war with most of Europe, and I'll give a little image here. This is not the best map in the world, nevertheless, it's one I could find which accurately shows the borders somewhat of the time. As you can see, France has effectively found itself, either by declaration or by the activation of alliances, at war with Great Britain, Prussia, the Netherlands, Austria, Russia, Spain, and all of their various connected alliances, so the lesser kingdoms of Italy, Portugal, and of course some various principalities in the Holy Roman Empire. Amidst France's war with most of the rest of Europe, as early as 1789, the idea had been floated of the need to replace the king's army with a people's army. De Conché declared to the National Convention after the proclamation of the Republic that for France to be free and ridden of factionalism, every citizen should be a soldier, and every soldier a citizen. Though the convention resisted the call to conscription at first, especially after the Battle of Valmy had ended the imminent threat of the revolution being toppled, though in many ways Danton's call to arms and the prelude to the September massacre had set the precedent of service to the revolution or death. Indeed, such was the confidence of the Girondin faction after the Battle of Valmy that the convention signalled its intention that France is not merely to be preserved, but to conquer, to liberate the citizens of the world in the cause of liberty. And of course, you see the pattern in the early stages of the revolution of exporting the revolution and forming various sister republics in the conquered territories. Nevertheless, with the defection of so many nobles who had made up the professional officer corps of the army and the ragtag and unreliable nature of the federes, the convention established levy quotas in the departments throughout France. By the middle of 1793, the French army stood at some 650,000 men. Nevertheless, with the entry of Spain into the war, France's military situation began to deteriorate yet again. In March, the French had entered into Germany and occupied parts of the West Bank, establishing, alongside the Jacobin Club in Mainz, the creation of a French-aligned sister republic in Mainz, only for the territory to be swiftly conquered and the army of the French under Alexandre de Beauharnais, who was also the first husband of Josephine Bonaparte and the father of Eugene, who would later be the viceroy of Italy and one of Napoleon's most courageous and effective relatives. He was responsible for the defeat of the French army in Mayence, and he was swiftly afterwards executed. 1 month after the fall of Mayence, the Minister of War, pictured here on the left, Lazare Carnot, also known by the revolutionaries as the organizer of victory, decreed the creation of a levée en masse, calling all men between the ages of 18 and 25 to service, more than doubling the size of the army in a year, while older men and women were called on to defend liberty through the production of armaments, bandages, the provision of food, etc. With the deployment of around 800,000 men by 1794, the French easily outnumbered the armies of many belligerent nations of the First Coalition. And despite the untrained nature of this popular rather than professional army, the tide began to turn in the French favour by the time of the coup of Thermidor with the Battle of Fleurus. Carnot's particular strategy evolved from this Vauban-esque defensive strategy with the construction of various fortresses, as exemplified, demonstrated with the Carnot Wall, into an aggressive offensive strategy that relied on speed, the superior logistics of the French army, and the maneuverability of several armies all at once acting in unison to prevail against smaller armies and meet and always tactically outnumber the army or against. And of course, using tactics such as this, the French armies were able to crush the coalition at the Battle of Vatigny, though French commanders such as Jourdan often had to deal with the threat of censure, execution, and the heavy hand of the Committee of Public Safety, of which Lazare Carnot was the prominent member, consistent member. With the creation of a republic, France was dominated by two political factions, the Girondins, who occupied the right of the convention, who were at once the war party and the constitutional party, taking their cue from the Americans, Thomas Paine serving as one of their deputies, and the Montagnards, the mountain faction, the left, the radicals, who supported a more democratic and egalitarian political system. After initially opposing the war, the Montagnards were now the fiercest exponents of retribution towards France's supposedly internal enemies. The September massacre and the trial of the king had demonstrated the fundamental differences in the factions' approaches, and already Robespierre had attempted to place prominent Girondins on proscription lists as an extension of the September massacres. The Montagnards benefited from the support of the sans-culottes, the revolutionary committees, and various supporters in the National Guard, and thereby had a virtual monopoly of violence in the capital, augmented when the Jacobins captured the mayoralty of Paris from a disinfected and jaded Girondin. Now the constitutional settlement around the king had collapsed, the Republicans had the convention, but needed a new constitution, and the Girondins took a leading role in the original framing of it. Despite the early commanding presence of the Girondins, their number continuously differed and vacillated on cracking down on the autonomous revolutionary organizations that were dominated by their political opponents, the Montagnards. Girondin timidity was in stark contrast to the pure bloodlust of Jean-Paul Marat, who demanded more and more heads of traitors from his revolutionary pulpit. In a major tactical blunder, Brissot consented to the formalization of the role of the Revolutionary Tribunal in order to place Marat before it, only for him to be acquitted and indeed emboldened, his prestige and his revolutionary fervor increased. Likewise, the Girondin Convention failed to crack down on Jacques Herbert and his radical faction, who had been inciting violence against the Girondins, arresting him only to release him amid a public backlash. Amidst all of this, a civil war had precipitated in the Vendée, at first as a response to the imposition of the military levy, but it soon became a major royalist insurrection of the entire people of that department. On the 2nd of June, the Jacobins, supported by the National Guard, responding to a Girondin suggestion for the army to march on Paris and to reclaim it from the awful Jacobins, purged the Girondist leadership from the convention and implemented price controls for bread, the law of the maximum. With the Girondins eliminated in the capital, Girondins in Lyon, Bordeaux, and Toulon began championing the cause of decentralization, earning the title of Federalist, again in imitation of the Americans. Throughout 1793, Federalist supporters, such as they were crushed by armies sent by the now Jacobin-dominated convention, often making common cause with royalists, such as at the Siege of Toulon, where a certain Napoleon Bonaparte led the Republican forces to victory, while the Royalist and the Federalist forces had opened the port provisionally to the British. The uprising in Lyon was suppressed by one Joseph Fouché, who oversaw the execution of some 2,000 rebels. As a nominal emergency measure, the provisional government had created a committee of defence in the absence of a proper executive for the purpose of waging the war. By April, this organisation was renamed to the Committee of Public Safety, and while all the powers were nominally vested in the National Convention, the committee soon emerged as the real source of power in France with its emergency powers. With the elimination of the Girondins, Jacobins, and again, it's maybe confusing that I'm using the word Montagnard and Jacobin interchangeably, but Jacobin has an evolving definition throughout this time. And after 1793 in particular, Jacobin almost becomes synonymous with Montagnard, but they aren't synonymous for this entire period of history. So do bear with me if it seems as if I'm using these words interchangeably. In particular, Saint-Just took over responsibility for drafting the new, far more radical constitution that emphasized not only national sovereignty, but popular sovereignty on the basis of universal suffrage, the abolition of slavery, combined with positive rights as opposed to simply negative rights, the right to work, welfare, education. In the ongoing state of national emergency, the Constitution's implementation was postponed and then from October postponed indefinitely. In July, Charlotte Corday, a Girondin from Caen, assassinated Jean-Paul Marat in his medicinal bath. But rather than simply remove the most vocal advocate for revolutionary violence, she created a revolutionary martyr. The revolution had coincided with the creation of the Church of Saint-Genevieve, which from 1790 was converted into a revolutionary equivalent of the Roman Pantheon, dedicated to the heroes of the nation and the servants of liberty. Supposedly. Mirabeau was the first to be entombed in this new revolutionary temple, followed by the ashes of Voltaire, who were placed in the Pantheon in a lavish ceremony. Mirabeau, as a moderate revolutionary and a constitutional monarchist, was loathed by the new republican leadership. His legacy was trashed, and he was damned in perpetuity as a foreign provocateur in the service of France's enemies. Mirabeau was removed and replaced with the remains of Jean-Paul Marat, and ultimately, as with Mirabeau, Marat's remains would be exhumed after the fall of Robespierre. Nevertheless, it's important to understand the amount of PR and myth-making that is going into venerating these new republican heroes, these republican saints. So here on the left, we have the famous painting by David depicting Marat as a revolutionary martyr, almost akin to Christ having been taken down from the cross. Here, this almost angelic, saintly creature, I know it sounds bizarre, but here it is, lying dead in his medicinal bath. Of course, he was using the medicinal bath because he suffered from a debilitating illness, which essentially caused his skin, I believe, to rot from spending an inordinate amount of time hiding away in the sewers in the aftermath of the massacre of Champ de Mort. Similarly, I've chosen all of these images on purpose. So here we have Robespierre. This is perhaps one of the most romantic representations of Robespierre I could find. And of course, it demonstrates him as, you know, rather magisterial. Nevertheless, Robespierre is, you know, rather a slight man. And of course, his face is potched, of course, the remnants of having had smallpox. And of course, then we have the image on the right, that of Saint-Just, perhaps the most preposterous of all, in that this image really emphasizes his childish innocence, when of course he is known as essentially the revolutionary's angel of death. So all of these images are at once indicative of the myth-making that's going around these revolutionary figures, but also a demonstration of absurdity. Faced with external war abroad, civil war among the revolutionaries, and a royalist uprising in the Vendée, Robespierre ascended to the Committee of Public Safety and declared from September that terror is the order of the day, realizing his own mantra in his political struggle against the Girondins some months before, and this on political morality: virtue and terror. Virtue without which terror is fatal. Terror without which virtue is impotent. Terror is nothing but prompt, severe, inflexible justice. It is therefore an emanation of virtue. Combined with the levy en masse, the army was to enforce the law of the maximum at the point of the bayonet, ensuring the continual support of the people of Paris for the Jacobins, while the artificially low price of bread, by forcing farmers to surrender grain, led to, and that again combined not only with that, but price fixing, wage fixing, while Paris was fed, the rest of France was starving. The constitution had delineated the conditions under which citizenship could be removed, and with it, the rights of the person, in contradistinction to the idea of inalienable or natural rights. Rather, rights were in the ken of the revolutionary government to be removed effectively at a whim during this time. With the passing of the law of suspects, denunciation was enough to merit imprisonment. With Saint-Just's Ventos decrees, Ventos, of course, one of being the new revolutionary months, suspects could have their property confiscated. As France was now in the thrall of a revolutionary church militant and nation under arms, the populace of France was treated under military conditions by their active service to the cause of the revolution. Indeed, judged by the extent of their pseudo-religious fervour. The precedent had already been set in 1791 with the constitution, with distinction between active and passive citizens. Now we are taking the idea of active citizen to the absolute limit and putting it in the state of emergency under military conditions. Nothing was more emblematic of this mandated reign of terror than the continuous flow of victims to the guillotine, Madame de Guillotine. From 1793 to 4, nearly 3,000 Parisians alone were guillotined, compared to around 17,000 throughout the totality of France, while at least another 20,000 were killed by other means. By the end of October of 1791, the imprisoned Girondin leadership had all been executed. While Robespierre, Saint-Just, Bertrand Barré, and Georges Cousson dominated France during the Terror, the man most responsible for the direct overthrow of the monarchy, Georges Danton, had gone into self-imposed exile after the trial of Marie Antoinette. He reluctantly returned to politics in November to denounce the scale of the executions and attacking the most radical faction of the Jacobins, led by Hébert. Even Robespierre didn't have the power at this time, nor Danton's popular flair, to cajole the population of Paris to effectively oppose him. By December, Danton had his own faction opposing the Committee of Public Safety, the Moderates, derisively known as the Indulgents. The claim of indulgence was levelled against the vices of Danton himself by Saint-Just as antithetical to the notion of republican virtue which Robespierre and his allies were attempting to inculcate. The committee, rather than acting directly against Danton, positioned itself between the moderates and the more radical Herbertists, distancing itself from both factions. Danton supporters were calling for the end of the terror and the emergency powers that came with it, which Robespierre interpreted as a ploy to seize the reins of the government after the state of the emergency. The Herbertists were less subtle in their desire to go further than the committee in terms of their zealousness and the terror. A Herbertist, Jean-Baptiste Carrière, had been sent to the city of Nantes at the mouth of the River Loire as part of the ongoing war in the Vendée as the Republic's representative on mission to suppress the rebellion there. There, he formed the Legion of Marat and promised to eliminate every counter-revolutionary, most notoriously during the Noyade, or the Drowning at Nantes, where he ordered the death of 94 priests. Carrière was part of the army that decisively defeated the Vendeans at the Battle of Savigny. After the news of the atrocity reached Paris, Carrière was recalled from Nantes to save some face from the Committee of Public Safety, while they didn't formally punish him for any of his excesses during the war. Herbert used this as a pretext in the Cordelier Club to demand the fall of Robespierre, and yet the sans-culottes sided with the committee against the more radical Herbertists, and on the 24th of March, the faction leadership was eliminated. In so doing, Robespierre had eliminated his opposition from the left while draining support for the anti-terror Dantonists. It didn't help also that Danton wasn't making effective strides to remove Robespierre immediately while forming an alliance with Camille Desmoulins that alienated Jacobins further when he collaborated on the newspaper Le Vieux Cordelier that declared that the terror had ended, attacked the anti-clericalism and de-Christianization of the revolutionaries, and suggested a negotiated peace. After removing the Herbertists, Robespierre felt confident to remove the opposition from his right, arresting Danton and Philippe Galité. And again, all of this in the case of Danton was ostensibly on the charges of theft, corruption, and collaboration with foreign interests. While it is undoubted that Danton was corrupt and committed a lot of shady dealings, bribery, corruption, fraud, there was no evidence to corroborate the fact that he was actually taking bribes deliberately from foreign powers. Nevertheless, the charge that he was wanting a negotiated settlement with France's enemies was enough in the minds of the Revolutionary Tribunal to substantiate those claims. Unwilling to let Danton appeal to support from the convention, Danton was sent to the Revolutionary Tribunal and, along with the leaders of the moderate faction, executed. By April of 1794, it appeared that Robespierre had eliminated all his opposition throughout France. By 1794, the revolution's persistent strain of anti-clericalism and anti-Catholicism had morphed into a full-fledged de-Christianization effort. Building upon the seizure of the church land, the subordination of the church, and the declaration of religious freedom from the beginning of the Republic, political violence was directed at those remaining non-jurors who hadn't fled already. Coupled with the violence against non-jurors, and indeed some jurors, religious icons, symbols, and churches were vandalized across France, while monasteries were either demolished or secularized, and often used as the various meeting clubs in Paris for these radical revolutionary sects. And religious orders, in addition, the Jesuits, etc., were abolished. Saint-Chapelle offered the revolutionaries as Saint-Chapelle, the famous church of Saint-Louis, offended the revolutionaries as both a Catholic holy site and reliquary, and an unmistakable bastion of the monarchy since Saint-Louis. Its royal emblems and sculptures were smashed, its spire torn down, its stained glass smashed, and the Grand Chasse, or the Grand Reliquary, was melted down. The fate of Saint-Chapelle was by no means an isolated incident. In August 1793, the convention ordered the violation of the sepulchres and the destruction of the Capetian royal tombs at the Basilica of Saint-Denis, including that of the Dauphin, Louis-Joseph, who had died just 5 years before at the age of seven. Piecemeal, such as with the Pantheon, churches across France were rededicated to the revolution, the nation, or to reason. By October 1793, at the height of the war in the Vendée, churches were closed and non-jurors, those accused of harboring them, were executed. Nevertheless, not all revolutionaries were anti-Christian in the sense that they were strictly materialists or atheists and or atheists. Voltaire, despite his anti-clerical polemicism, was deist And so came the question of what form of religious heterodoxy to replace Christianity with. The Enlightenment had preached the triumph of reason and progress, combined with Rousseau's affection for nature and primordialism. Despite the romantic association with neoclassicism, pagan motifs were more symbolic effigies than genuinely religious. The first such movement to gain momentum during the Revolution was the atheistic cult of reason, as championed by the Herbertists and Joseph Fouché. Marmoro attempted to synthesize this collection of ideas into a doctrine as a humanist religion dedicated to truth and the ideal of reason. As such, it was to be a democratic civic belief system, a religion of man. In November of 1793, Marmoro and Hebert devised a festival of reason in the Notre Dame de Paris, though churches across France were transformed into temples of reason in imitation of this main festival taking part in Paris. Instead of an altar to Christ, there was an altar to liberty, and to enter a temple of reason was supposedly to embark on the idea of philosophy. While pagan and Roman imagery abounded, Marmoro was insistent that such illusions or personifications to say, for example, the goddess of liberty were just that, illusions. There was no attempt to create some form of revolutionary equivalent of the transubstantiation. The excesses of the cult, whose festival was often described as depraved, was opposed by Robespierre's idea of virtue and Danton's Christian sympathies. Without official support, the cult was purged by Robespierre after the fall of Hebert. In contrast to what Robespierre considered the farce of the cult of reason, Robespierre, at the height of his power, promulgated a religion of his own making, which was authorized by the National Convention a month following the execution of Danton. For Robespierre, reason was a false idol, merely an end to the true goal that was virtue, a political mantra that was now made a state-sanctioned religion. The cult of the supreme being would develop an embryonic system of deism, followed by Voltaire and his adherents, in a way that was meant to combine the civic virtues of classical Roman republicanism, namely fides, fidelity, loyalty, justitia, justice, or temperantia, temperance, with the belief in a monotheistic god tied to the immortality of the human soul. Without a republican godhead, any such political system would devolve into nihilism and debauchery. Rather than the demonstration of Robespierre's detachment from reality, as is often claimed, the creation of the cult is consistent with his attempt to abolish factionalism in the Montagnard camp, creating a republican doctrine of faith to appeal to the radicals, while including some superficial allusions to Christianity to appeal to the former Dantonists, formalizing the extant religiosity of the revolution into a bona fide religion, which could serve as an ideological basis to cement the gains of the revolution and Robespierre's own power as some form of revolutionary equivalent of Innocent III, combining secular and religious authority, indeed a Roman emperor, as both tribune of the people and Pontifex Maximus, the bridge builder. In that capacity, as the cult's high priest, the cult was inaugurated on the 8th of June 1794, or the 20th of Parial on the Champ de Mars. David organized for Robespierre to stand atop a fantastical man-made mountain and deliver a sermon on the essential nature of virtue. The specific emphasis on a religious revolutionary choreography, the meticulous nature of the planning, was meant to set the tone for a future republican series of celebrations to be held at the end of every republican week or every 10 days. The festival of the supreme being was meant to cement Robespierre's hold on power. Despite this, Robespierre's health had been in freefall since the fall of Danton, and at the moment where Robespierre should have been fully in command of the government, he stayed away from meetings of the Committee of Public Safety. Having personally led the processions of the festival, the conspicuous power and ambition of Robespierre was such that his allies began to question where this would lead to, and question their own fates as a consequence. Justifying those fears, seemingly, 2 days later, the convention passed an act that extended the purview for political crimes and accelerated the process of trials, though it wasn't universally accepted by the convention. if anything, trying to fan the flames of Robespierre's paranoia. In this instance, Robespierre had effectively registered the act with the convention, akin to the lit de justice, which even the most powerful of the absolutist monarchs of France couldn't achieve, without even consulting the Committee of General Security, the sister committee to the Committee of Public Safety that oversaw the terror. Robespierre's conspicuous absence increased after a failed assassination attempt, during which he deputized Saint-Just. On the 28th of June, France, under Jourdan, defeated the Austrians decisively at the Battle of Flourens, after which France retained the initiative throughout the War of the First Coalition and occupied Belgium and the left bank of the Rhine. The victory was seized on by the remnants of the right faction of the committees and the convention to finally suspend the war government and implement the Constitution of 1793. Chief among this faction was Lazare Carnot, the organizer of victory, who denounced Saint-Just and Robespierre, who would not end the emergency. When they wouldn't end the emergency, Carnot declared them to be dictators. With the suspicion that both Robespierre and Saint-Just were ruling France through pure fiat, Robespierre arrived at the convention to defend his record and denounce his opponents, but the vagueness of his speech, his inability to name more than three deputies who he accused of treason, created pandemonium to the in the convention, driven by paranoia of an arbitrary purge. To further antagonize the delegates, upon delivering the same speech later to the Jacobin Club, Jacobins began removing anyone they considered to be anti-Robespierre, such as Collot. Returning to the convention the next day, the two, Saint-Just and Robespierre, were denounced by the convention and disowned by the various committees, who condemned Robespierre as a tyrant and not one of us. The convention then declared him and his allies, Couthon, Saint-Just, etc., as outlaws. Despite being taken to prison, they were shortly freed afterwards by members of the Paris Commune, the Parisian revolutionary government, and set up in the Hôtel de Ville, hoping that the army and the National Guard would come to their deliverance. Nevertheless, the Hôtel de Ville was stormed that night by forces loyal to the convention, motivated perhaps more than anything by the desire to stay alive and avoid the guillotine. Robespierre, Saint-Just, Couthon were among the 21 men to be executed that very same day by the guillotine. The government was now in hands of the conspirators against Robespierre, the Thermidorians, Paul Barras, Jean Labertalion, Joseph Fouché, with the support of some figures such as Carnot and Barrère, who had defected, Jacobins, centrists, and members of the committees who had opposed Robespierre at the end. With the fall of Robespierre, the old political delineations crumbled, and a tentative coalition of Thermidorians was held together by a desire to limit the excesses of the emergency regime and the terror. With the fear of Robespierre gone, the government organized the Muscardin, government irregulars who went after Robespierre's supporters after, oxymoronically, a period called the White Terror, despite this mainly being an intra-Republican dispute perpetrated by Girondists, crypto-Girondists, throughout France with an axe to grind against those who orchestrated the terror, namely against them. Unlike the state-sanctioned terror, this terror was uncoordinated, except when the movements were explicitly royalist. Indeed, royalism was tolerated by the new regime, insofar as they directed their attacks against Jacobins. The Thermidor reaction is the word often used by historians on the left to indicate a general backsliding of a revolution, hence the term reactionary, the Thermidor reaction. And of particular interest this period is to Marxists, indeed Leon Trotsky, aftermath of his deposition in the Soviet Union, would draw an analogy between Barras and Stalin and equivocate this effectively backlash in the Soviet Union as the Soviet Thermidor. Unlike the Girondins of 1792 and 3, the Thermidorians were not afraid of suppressing their enemies. The Montagnard faction was placed under a cordon sanitaire, with all of its membership excluded from positions of power. And the Paris Commune, that had aided Robespierre during the coup of Thermidor, was purged. Marat's legacy, Jean-Paul Marat, was officially denounced, and his remains removed from the Pantheon. The cult of the supreme being seemingly faded overnight. A new constitution was implemented and the National Convention made way for the new directory with a permanent executive and a bicameral legislature, the Council of the 500 and the Council of the Ancients, re-implementing the notions of the checks and balances, effectively doing a lot to restore elements of the 1791 Constitution, if not go that bit further and imitate more the American Constitution, not to the extent that there is a single executive in the form of the presidency, because the Directory is a five-man executive. Following the defeat of the Vendeans after the Battle of Savenay, General Thuriau waged indiscriminate warfare on the royalist civilians of the Vendée throughout 1794, leading to some 50,000 deaths. In total, some 300,000 people perished in the war in the Vendée. Thuriau was replaced after Thermidor by Hoche, who attempted a negotiated settlement with the Vendeans, guaranteeing their freedom of religion. The royalist cause was then taken up across Brittany, Mans, and Normandy by the Choanovais, a guerrilla movement. On the 8th of June, Louis XVII died from neglect in the temple, reigniting sympathy for the royalist cause throughout France. Louis XVII, of course, was the child of Louis XVI, who had been kept by the revolutionaries and had been orphaned and now had been killed, essentially starved to death. A British expeditionary force arrived in Brittany with scattered royalist elements under the leadership of the Comte de Pousset. The expedition, however, turned out to be a disaster for the royalists and was decisively defeated by the revolutionaries under General Hoche, in addition to damaging Pousset's reputation among the royalists. Nevertheless, the royalists remained at large in France, and even the Comte d'Artois, the later Charles X, the youngest brother of King Louis, supported by Britain, landed in the Vendée. With D'Artois in France, there was an uprising of royalists in Paris itself, and surprisingly, even members of the National Guard defected to the royalists. The Thermidorians were forced to recall Jacobins to put down the rebellion, yet their commander, Menou, failed to subdue the royalists, after which Jean-Paul Barras took personal power over the army conducting the war against the royalists in Paris and delegated that authority to one Napoleon Bonaparte. Confronted with a group of 7,000 royalists, Napoleon ordered his artillery to fire volleys of grape shot into their ranks for 2 hours before the arrival of Joachim Murat's cavalry that dispersed the royalists. The defeat of the Paris insurrection temporarily stabilized the weak Thermidorian government and set the stage for the meteoric rise of Napoleon Bonaparte. Of course, this moment was immortalized in Thomas Carlyle's History of the French Revolution by describing Napoleon's Bonaparte's actions as giving them a whiff of the grape shot. In concert with the royalist attacks on the Republic, lingering Jacobite elements attempted a coup in Paris. In May of 1795, akin to Danton's original insurrection, or at least it was meant to be. This failed, and with the failure of the monarchist action throughout France, the Constitution of 1795 was officially implemented, beginning the era of the Directory. Nevertheless, a new threat opposed the government from the left, the followers of the Jacobite François Noël Babeuf, who assumed the epithet of Gracchus after Tiberius Gracchus, with the aim of establishing economic equality in France. An idea was floated at the height of the Robespierre, but ultimately abandoned as impractical. Through Babeuf's Tribune of the People, his newspaper, he advocated for mass wealth redistribution to achieve economic equality in France and gained a readership among various ostracized Jacobins. The Republic at this time was dealing with the aftermath of Robespierre's ruinous economic policies that resulted in food shortages and hyperinflation. Together with Salvien Maréchal and Pierre Antonin Babeuf created a secret society to orchestrate the overthrow of the government. Despite this, Fouché, as director of police, had established a network of informants, often bringing back Jacobins from the era of the terror, and by 1796, Napoleon had closed down the Jacobin meeting place in Paris. Babeuf's own organization was infiltrated by the Directory of Police. Babeuf had planned to orchestrate a general mutiny of the army at Grenelle and an insurrection of the lower orders of Paris. Grenelle was a military camp just on the outskirts of Paris. Aware of his plan, Babeuf was arrested along with his supporters in waves carried out across France. Despite attempts to spring Babeuf from prison various times, he, along with 30 of his co-Jacobin co-conspirators, were guillotined. The failure of what was later dubbed the Conspiracy of Equals ended any possibility of a government overthrow by the left. the Directory government remained a weak government with little leadership, commanding the enthusiastic support of very few. Nevertheless, the memory of Babeuf and his advocacy of economic equality, which made little impression other than the footnote across the tumultuous decades of the revolution, was kept alive by Philippe Buonarroti and his 1828 History of Babeuf's Conspiracy of Equals, which became a foundational historical text for the Marxists of the 19th century. And it is here where we leave off and I come back. I'm actually going to postpone tomorrow's lecture and come back on Sunday because I'm finding this more exhausting than I anticipated, unfortunately. So I will be back on Sunday to conclude this initial phase on these specifically French aspects of the revolution by talking about the era of Napoleon from 1796 up until 1812 in France in the lecture titled Napoleonic France. Thank you for those who have sent super chats. I'm going to be answering all super chats at the end of Sunday's lecture, if that is all right. So thank you everyone for sending super chats. But I really want to get all the discussion portion and all the questions in the French Revolution done in the final stream. So thank you everyone for listening. Do tune in everyone on Sunday to watch the episode on Napoleonic France. And I wish you all a good night. Also, do remember, if you liked this lecture, to like the video, leave a comment, and subscribe to the channel Apostolic Majesty. Thank you ever so much, and goodbye.